as it initially was when the antenna points and had it. I look at the background noise or the background area where that, when that signal diminished by about 30-something dB or so. And then I can see this noise energy come up and go, you know, come up and go down as they apply power and de-apply power to the light, fixture. And what I did was I just had some components to figure, well, let me just try this. I have nothing to lose. I took an 82 PF cap, rated about 1,000 volts, and I wired it across the actual wire connections going to the socket that provides power to these three sockets that you put these bulbs into. That seemed to reduce it by a factor of maybe about 10 dB or so. So it sort of proved that some of the energy is coming out backwards, out and being induced into the wiring that's supplying power to these devices back to you, because I tried cutting one bulb apart with an X-Acto knife. However they glue these together, it's impossible. I don't know how these things are put together, but you can't take it apart to even attempt to repair it at the source. That's just not possible. So I had to try another method of trying to eliminate some of the interference being radiated.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Really, line still being really rough.
Yeah, give us some words on that one, Eric.
Yeah, most of these things are buck regulators with a freaking halfway of diodes in the front end to make these things, and they go from there. So there's very little room for big capacitors to try and filter out the little switching noises that it makes on the power line.
Yeah, when it comes to fluorescent lighting, light-emitting diodes, CFLs, compact fluorescent, yeah, all of these are capable of making lots of noise depending on the design of the power supply that's inside of them. That power supply is connected to your 110-volt line, feeding it. That 110-volt line, by definition, is an antenna radiating the stuff all over your house. And now, your offended appliance in another room, is it because of conducted EMI or radiated EMI? And the answer is yes and yes. You're getting both. And therefore, which one is dominant is almost academic. To stop it at the source is the right way to do it. In some cases, that's going to require putting an electromagnetic shield over it and putting in a filter con equivalent. In other words, a so-called, let me drop it. What in the military world is called a dirty box filter network. And on Air Force aircraft, you've got individual boxes for the electronics that's on that airplane. They're called line replaceable units, LRUs. And the LRU has got, in many cases, 400 cycle, 120 volt or 240 volt power going into it. And the very first thing that the power going into your individual box sees is this filter network that's trying to filter all of the frequencies going on inside your box to make sure that none of them come out on that wiring of that raw power going in, the so-called dirty filter. Well, a dirty box filter network is usually 1 microfarad to ground on each side, and it's a 1 microfarad oil-filled 400-volt capacitor, an expensive item. It's a device that's about 3/4 of an inch in diameter, about 2.5 inches long, and there's a pair of them in there. That's just the 1 microfarad capacitor of that dirty box. There's also an inductor in there. So, in theory, your fluorescent lighting, if you wanted to follow the same rules for radio frequency interference that the Air Force uses, it would cost you quite a few bucks for the filtering of that power supply. And by the way, the box itself is a perfect hermetic seal. Let me drop it. Should have said a perfect Faraday shield. So as you can tell, a raw power supply that just simply rectifies 110 volts to make DC out of it, boy, that's a wicked thing to try to filter. So you've got a fairly serious challenge here, Joe. As you apply more and more effort to this, you're going to knock it down 5 dB, 10 dB, 15 dB with each one of your efforts. You're never going to get it perfectly clean. So this is one of the rubs of using modern-day lighting versus old-fashioned incandescent bulbs. Incandescent bulbs did not do this. So we may be getting a 10 to 1, a 20-to-1 increase in efficiency of lumens output versus raw voltage going in, raw power going in. So it looks like we're going to be paying the price for some time to come on radio frequency interference. There's not going to be a simple solution on this. I'd like to believe somebody downrange, somebody like the independent laboratories. Let me drop it. I'd like to believe that Underwriters Laboratory, if they haven't already done it, I'd like to believe sometime in the near future, they're going to choose all of the popular brands and make specific measurements of how much radiated and conducted radio interference they create. And once you and I read that manual, we'll know how many microvolts of interference at what frequency we're going to get versus how many dollars we spend when we buy brand A versus brand B. We're rapidly approaching the time when that measurement's got to be made, because a fair number of people are starting to run into this problem. You're not the first one, Joe. You're the first one that's getting really digging into it, and you're discovering that they built it in such a way you can't take it apart, maybe not even with a Dremel tool. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet.
WS2N comment.
Go ahead, Paul.
I've been lucky from what I've been hearing. I bought these bulbs. I have them on top of my computer. Another one probably about 8 inches away from my HF radio and 2 meter radio. I've been playing around now for a year and a half now with these bulbs, and they're doing good. So, I mean, I don't think they're going to last as long as they say, but right now, no interference anyway. I got three in this room alone. It's a small room.
They'll last longer than you think.
Yeah, tell us what brand name you bought. How many dollars did you spend? What brand name did you bought? And are you talking about a complex compact fluorescent, or are you talking about light-emitting diodes? So what kind of bulb, what brand name, how many dollars? And it looks like you're one of the lucky guys that didn't run into interference. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead. boy, I'm terrible tonight. You know who you are. Paul, you got a bulb.
I remember Eric saying the prices were coming down. He's right. About a year and a half ago, I paid about $6 for one bulb. And I went from there. I kept buying, you know, every once in a while you see a sale and you keep buying them. And I got them from Ace Hardware. Now, I noticed one that I have outside, you know, I leave it on every night. And I quit after about a year and a half. But I'm banging that door all the time, you know. I think the vibration got to it. I don't think they're what you would call rough service bulbs. You know, you could used to be able to buy rough service bulbs for all these, you know, if you were, you know, working on a car, you put it into a drop light. I don't think they make that. So that one finally failed, and I bought a couple more. And it's made by... How do you pronounce it? It's FEIT. FEIT is the brand. And they seem to be pretty good. I just bought Natter on sale again. Two for, it was like, I don't know, $5, two for $6. You can't go wrong. It's good for experimenting with it. But they're very good there.
Hey,
yeah, before we go over to Erica, Paul, what is the equivalent wattage? Did you buy the equivalent of a 60-watt fluorescent, flip to 60-watt incandescent bulb? In other words, it's got the same number of lumens. What size bulb are we talking about here? How many lumens or how many watts equivalent? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, those from Ace Hardware. I got all 9.5 watts. It's equivalent to 40 watts, but they're brighter than the old 40 watts. So I find they're equivalent to my old 60 watts. And for instance, the one on by the ham radio, it's in an architect light, you know, so I can move up and down real close to what my work, whatever I'm looking at. And then for the heck of it, I just bought another one from Walmart. The light itself, it's completely sealed. You plug it in, it's got a nice switch on it, and a very small table lamp, and that's in here now too. But that bulb's not replaceable, that's something else. But yeah, they're all 9.5 watts. The equivalent for 40 watt bulbs. So maybe the higher watt ones, maybe they have maybe they're emitting RF, I don't know. But these are good.
thing to worry about, though, Paul, is the color rendition. Some of these are kind of bluish, some of these are kind of orangish. Were you happy with the color of the bulb, of the lighting you got? I mean, incandescent bulbs really give you a kind of an orangey lighting that we're, or yellowish lighting that we've become familiar with. And some of these more modern bulbs is very bluish and kind of harsh. So were you happy with the color out of those bulbs, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can't tell the difference. They all look like exactly like the other bulbs, as far as I'm concerned. But then I did want to buy one. My wife wanted like a bluish look in the kitchen, you know, over the sink. So they had the same brand, and they called it natural, and it gave off like a bluish glow to it. Now the only thing is, some of these you got to watch are not dimmable. I don't have that situation, you know, where you're going to hook it up to a rheostat. You got to watch that. So, you know, the ones I buy are probably, they say they're not dimmable, so it's probably a little less expensive. You know, maybe you have to pay, you know, still $5 for one or something. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the last time that Eric told us about this, that there's a rather small percentage of these light-emitting diodes that have the right kind of a power supply that will survive the majority of the majority of the dimmer circuits that we know about. So Eric's going to tell us about this, all of the above. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
A couple points. K2RIW, KE2EJ. When you buy a light bulb, you'll notice that there's a Kelvin value. What you're used to seeing with your filament lit bulbs was around 3,200 degrees Kelvin. The ones that you claim are blue and harsh are 6,000 or 6,400 degrees. Actually, what we use in the studio, I can actually control the color temperature of the light. It's actually done by using multiple LED elements, each one being having a different phosphor in it. All of these LED lighting bulbs that we talk about are actually secondary emission devices, whereas you're not seeing the LED directly, you're seeing it indirectly. You're seeing a phosphor that's being excited. That's why they have a life of X number of hours. And phosphors fade after a while. Here's a 9-watt bulb. Actually, the way it usually goes for most LED bulbs, 9 watts would be equivalent to a 60-watt incandescent bulb producing, I forget what the number of lumens are, but it's an equivalent value. 100-watt LED bulbs draw something like 18 watts of actual energy here. The 40-watt bulbs are supposed to be 6.5 watts of energy here. It varies by manufacturer in terms of how they construct it, whether they're using 1-watt elements, 2-watt elements. The current draw on the different devices is a little bit different when they drop. Now, as far as dimming LED bulbs, that has taken a number of years to come up with a standard that works across the board. There's a couple of issues with that. I think we even had a discussion about it a year ago in terms of the dimmers. The way the bulbs work is you can't, in essence, take a switching power supply and make it make different values of light, so to speak, in the bulb in terms of just varying voltages. You know, the LEDs operate at a particular point of the knee of the diode where it starts to emit light. So the way that we control the brightness is by doing pulse width modulation. And your old type of dimmer, which was a triac, basically did the PWM on the line, and that in turn would make the filament glow dim or bright, depending upon how much energy you use. Well, with this power supply in between the LED and the power line, that concept doesn't work. Actually, if you put it on one of those types of dimmers, you usually blow up the power supply in the lamp. So the way that it works now, you have the manufacturers finally got together and everybody decided that they would take pretty much the same track, and let it drop again. In essence, what these LED type dimmers do is they don't actually, now let's put it this way, they impose a square wave on the line going to the bulb, bulb has an actual little cap that goes through the switching regulator that comes directly from the line, and they filter out this little switch signal. And depending upon the width of that, will actually determine the pulse width of the oscillator that's making the DC for the bulb. So there were a couple of different methods, and a lot of them didn't work with other ones, so that's the issue with dimming. And by the way, when you put one of these dimmers on the line, you're making noise from the dimmer. Forget about the bulb making noise. K2OIW, K2J.
K2OIS.
K2OIS. Sounds like Ocean Yankee Sierra. Start off with your name, sir, and your information. K2LAW in the tech net.
Roger, Dick. This is KC2OIS, Mark in Queens. When you want to dim a, either a CFL or LED, what you have to do is you have to use a CL-type dimmer. Otherwise, your lights might start blinking. So you have to keep that in mind. It's not really any more than the standard dimmer. Let's say you wanted a Lutron dimmer, you wanted a Diva, so you would get a CL153 dimmer, which is good up to like 150 watts of LED wattage, or up to 600 watts of incandescent light. So you could dim both on the same dimmer, so you're better off buying a CL type dimmer. Let me let it drop. As far as the if you, let's say you're going to get recessed lights, I think one of the best ones, I don't mean to advertise or anything, but I think if you're going to do recessed lights, you could probably pick up something by Amerlux. They're made here in Jersey, made in the United States. And these recessed lights are, you could order them in 120, which means that you could use a standard tri-act dimmer. They run anywhere from, some of them are 18 watts up to 23 watts, so they are quite bright. The new type of LEDs, what they call WD, warm dimming. So with a standard LED, what happens is when you dim it, it keeps the same color temperature. If you use a WD, it dims down, it glows down just like a incandescent light. Over to you, Dick.
Good information, Mark. I don't think I got your call that is right. Kilo Charlie 2, Ocean Yankee Sierra is what it sounded like. What's the three letters of your suffix, Mark? Go ahead.
So that would be KC2 Oscar India Sierra.
Oscar India Sierra. In other words, the last letter is S, like Susan.
Roger that. S is in Philly.
Okay. Gotcha. Regal Park. Now I got the right one. Thank you for your information. Looks like you're going down a pretty interesting path here, Joe, to solve the RFI problem. I don't think it's going to be easy, but we're slowly getting a little bit smarter. And one quick question I've got for Eric. Eric, I am guessing the light-emitting diode itself is running at whatever frequency it's most efficient, which might be ultraviolet. And the ultraviolet out of the real diode hits the phosphor, and then depending on what brand of phosphor they're using, that determines what color temperature we get. And in your case, you've got a whole lot of individual bulbs in your lighting fixtures, some of which are warm, some of which are cold, and by determining what ratio of the warm ones versus the cold ones allows you to adjust the overall color temperature. Is that approximately what's going on, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, in the words of Dick Nadel, K2RIW, give that man a cigar. Yeah, actually, what OIS just described is on the amount of energy it's absorbing. We have lights that are like that, but the problem with that for us is that it reduces the output. We have to maintain a certain number of foot candles on particular scenes, so that's why we use the multiple elements, so that way we can always maintain the same amount of energy hitting the set, even though we've changed the temperature of what we're hitting it with. Dick, go ahead.
Thank you, Eric. So, Joe, overall, you've opened up a darn good subject here tonight, these modern-day lighting fixtures. They've all got their idiosyncrasies. We're going to have to learn to live with them. How many of them can be dimmed? When you dim them, do you still get the same color intensity, even though you're getting less lumens? Lots of stuff's going on. So we're going to be discussing this one for a while to come. Back to you for a final, Joe, before we go on. And you're allowed to come back next week with more of this one. To B2RYY, because a lot of us are running into the problem. K2RIW, you got a joke?
Comment, Dick, and to you.
Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I want to ask you something. And are you going down the direction of the dimmable things and down that avenue? And I don't use dimmable fixtures, so I'm not dimming the lights. But my question, I guess the enclosure of the thing, if I had to make up a filter, and I wanted to make the filter have the best effect of RF emission, RFI, being radiated along out of the wiring, I don't even know if I have to put it on both legs, the neutral leg and the hot leg, but what would you say, just as an estimate, I'd be better off doing? Using something with a capacitor to ground and a L in series to power, and if that seems to be the best way of going, using like an LT type of filter, would you want the reactants fairly high compared to the capacitive reactants? Those of it to be able to, you know, short as much RF to ground as possible. Would you go in that direction?
No, you can buy a commercially made RFI block.
Tell us about that, Eric. How many dollars, what brand name, where do you buy it? And do you think they come to the power levels that he's talking about in a reasonable size package? Over to you for on that one, Eric.
Yeah, today just about every device that you plug a power cord into, you know, a detachable power cord with the three pins on it, plugs into a thing, and there's a switch next to it, sometimes there'll be fuses next to it. That's a little RFI EMI connector. Literally, the connector's got the stuff built into it. They make tiny little ones for little power lines, and they make big ones that can do 20 amps, you know, so. And you can get them from DigiKey and Newark and all those various places.
Yeah, but I'm using, I'm trying to take care of the lights that are in a ceiling fan, okay? So I have to do two things, either take the ceiling fan completely apart and try to put the components in the actual electrical wiring past where the fan is, or I could do it something, I have some sort of room inside the thing. These are not plugging into the wall. That's where this started from. That's why they're asking about L's and C's and using particular values. So what would you suggest, Dick, to try to use a fairly high reactance component compared to the reactance of the capacitor in an LT circuit? Something I'm gonna have to make myself. I don't think I'm going to be able to buy it. But I want to try to knock off the RF at fairly high frequency. And the funny thing about noticing what the RF is doing was, it seemed to be, like I said before, it seemed to be somewhere around 180, 185 megahertz up to about 235. As it went much, much higher, much, much lower, I saw that seem to diminish as far as what I see. So there only seemed to be one sort of band of frequencies within plus or minus, you know, 20, 30 megahertz, centered around the best, the highest level, about 205, 210. That was energy coming out of this bulb. And I hopefully most of it is being inducted into the wiring. That's, you know, where the problem is, because if it's inducted, if it's being radiated rather than the bulb itself, that's going to be a very, very tough thing to stop. Back to you.
On up. Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
What were you saying, Eric?
It sounds to me like he's not dealing with expensive bulbs, you know. Why not just go buy some other bulbs that are quiet? Go out and find, get one from this manufacturer and that manufacturer and find out which ones don't make noise and use them instead. A lot less trouble than having to put a filter together. By the way, the filters I was talking about, They come very tiny. You could actually fit them behind the base of the lamp if you needed to do that. So, I mean, you're talking about putting some coils and capacitors together, and it's two wires in, two wires out. But whatever.
Is he 2OAS?
Eric, the thing you're talking about, does it have male prongs and female prongs, and you just put this in between, or is this something that you wire into a circuit? And once again, how many dollars, what brand name, and where do you buy them? Over to you, Eric.
The low power ones come with four terminals on. It's a little square box. It's about, I think it's like a half inch by an inch, something like that. Real tiny. They make them that have the three-prong socket built in, a switch, and that actually terminates into three terminals, one to hook to the ground of your chassis, and the other two are your AC line coming in. The big ones, I think, have ferrite inductors in them with coils wound around them and capacitors, and they're really good. And they're very broad. They cover a whole big range of frequencies. And you got really big ones, and they come in various different price ranges. I think the little tiny ones are something like $1.50 or $2 a piece. And you get them from places like DigiKey and Newark and Allies and so on and so forth. And there's hundreds of different kinds.
That's good information. And the closer you can get to the source with this filter network, Eric, I mean, Joe, the better you're going to do. If you try to filter, you know, 5 feet, 10 feet downrange on the power cord, and all that power cord is acting as an antenna, it's going to be giving you some grief. I know that we've got both Rich and Mark in that order with some further comments. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead with your comment, Rich.
KD2HUC with the question.
HUC recognized, you're on the list. Go ahead there, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I came in a little late on this particular subject, but maybe I'm a little off, I don't know. I have an LED light fixture in this room, and you know where the antenna is. You helped put it up with Barry, so it's not far away. And I have no RFI. I was worried about that. I have a contractor that's doing work for me in the house. He put it up. I checked HF, all the bands. I checked 2 meters, 440. Absolutely no problem. I guess it's got a cluster of LEDs. The only thing I'm unhappy with is it's not bright enough for me, which is a whole different subject, so I'm having him change it to compact fluorescence. Back to that.
Sounds like you're one of the lucky guys, Rich, that's not getting any interference.
Lucky. The majority of them don't make noise.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Mark, KC2OIS, go right ahead, Mark.
Right, like, as far as the fans are concerned, this guy's having a problem with the fans. I don't know about building anything or, you know, avoiding any kind of warranty from the manufacturer or UL thing. But as far as the fans are concerned, you got fans like modern fans. They have they use fluorescence in there, and obviously they use like G9 bulbs and stuff like that, which you could also obtain some LED bulbs to make bipins and G9s and stuff like that and LED. But the thing is that what they normally do, they have a non-dimming on the light. So when you buy your RF switch on the wall for the, you know, with the receiver board inside the canopy, you know, you set your dip switches and stuff, you know, normally what happens is they don't allow you to dim. They tell you to buy a non-dimming as far as that's concerned. Let me let it drop a second. There is a company, Fanimation. They have a new line of fans right now, and they have LED lights, which are pretty bright, on the bottom of the fan, and they are dimmable. So, you know how it is. They're creating this whole business with this new stuff. So, you know, people are going out buying all kinds of stuff. But, yeah, so you could check into, you know, getting a different fan maybe that you can dim it. And then what I would do is call up a customer support at the company if you see something that you like and ask them about the concern that you have about interference on the line. We all know that fluorescents do that. So, you know, an LED is very similar to the fluorescent. So that's what I would suggest with the fans. Some are non-dimming, and I know you guys are you're engineers and you like to experiment, but you don't want to start a fire in the house. And I see my mother's fan, may she rest in peace, her fan caught fire before she got sick. And I had to take that fan down and put a light up. Over to you, Dick.
Run that by again, Mark. What created the fire in the fan? A dimmer circuit or some other kind of failure? What was the failure that made fire in the fan? And a fire at the ceiling sounds to me like it could get kind of serious. Over to you, Mark.
One day I was sitting there eating, and it was after dinner, and I'm smelling like smoke. You know, wire burning, and I walk into the kitchen. You know, it was an old fan. It was a very old fan, actually. We changed the light kit. It had incandescent bulbs in it. She had 360-watt bulbs, and the light kit caught fire. So I had to take the fan down. And eventually I wound up getting her... I changed one of her fans. I got her a Casablanca fan in the dining area. Before she died, and she loved that fan. It was a beautiful fan, and had high gloss blades, light kit, everything. But the thing in the kitchen, I changed the light, but the light wasn't, it was a tech lighting fixture. But it didn't hold the wattage, it wasn't as bright enough, as bright as the three lights that were on the fan. So that was the problem. As far as getting the LEDs, I prefer the 3000K. But that's going to give you the brightness that you need. That's on the high end of warm. So you got 24, 27, and 3000 K. So Dick, you know, as far as these trying to convert this to wattage, there's really no way of converting this to the watts, because one company can have a watt of, let's say, 10 watts. And another company can have 10 watts, but the brightness is different, so it doesn't compare. You really can't compare it, the watts of incandescent to the wattage of the LED with the lumens, where the lumens aren't exactly the same.
What I think you're saying, Mark, is that the lumens of an incandescent, which has got a lot of red in it, versus the lumens of a light-emitting diode, which might be a lot more blue, the eye doesn't respond quite the same way, so they're not the same kind of lumens. And I think there's a way of making a lumen eye equivalent, but I'm going to go there. Steve, I know you want to ask a question, KD2HUC, and if your question is on the subject on the floor, no problem. If it's on a brand new subject, then we can't go to you immediately. There's somebody ahead of you. KD2HUC, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
Hey, KD2HUC. Now, Dick, my question is for the topic that's on the floor. I'm just curious if Joe's ceiling fan, you know, if it was a retrofit, if it was put up, or was it a new install? Was it put on an existing circuit, or was it a new install? And if so, if it was just a retrofit, is it properly grounded? You know, most of the houses on Long Island, when they were built, grounding wasn't required. I know my house, most of the cabling is not grounded. And I've had to spend a lot of time chasing down a couple of appliances in my house that were just beating me up with RFI. My wife's treadmill, we had a flat screen TV, and, you know, even though they're plugged into three-prong outlets, there's nothing on the third prong. Slowly but surely, I'm converting the wiring over to, you know, three conductor. But, so that was my question. KB2HUC, back to net.
Okay, that was your subject there, Mark. So, do you have an answer for Steve? Steve. KC2OIS, K2IW. You got it, Mark.
Stepped away for a sec about her. I'm talking about something about grounding, but New York State is, everything is grounded in New York State. Once you touch something to the box, it's already grounded. But now, like in New York City, I believe, I don't know the rules, but, you know, they just want more money. So they're asking for you to connect the ground wire from the fixture to the box. They want you to ground it, even though the box, the building, it's grounded already with the pipes. So I'm not sure about, I don't know the law or anything like that, but you have to check locally. I think there's only like I think there's only like two states that are not grounded. You know, and you have to be very careful with not grounding. You know, I know people that, you know, sometimes these people they don't have a neutral wire. So what they do is like a, you know, I used to go fix fans, and like I go touch the fan, I get a shock right away. You know, and that's what they do. They're cheating. They're hooking it up to the ground instead of to a neutral. And it could cause havoc when you go up to change a bulb or something like that, or have a repair. I hope I answered the question. Over to you.
Yeah, let me repeat the question, Mark. Steve was asking, of the fire that you got, was the fire in the lighting fixture? Was the fire in the fan motor itself? And was it a grounding problem that created the fire, if you know? KC2OIS, K2LIW.
Dick, my question was for Joe, RYY, not for Mark, for his RFI problem.
Okay, yeah. No matter how he's grounded, if his circuit is making electromagnetic interference, if it's making radio frequency interference, he's going to see it. I mean, there are lots of people who think that if you've got standing wave ratio on your antenna and you're properly grounded, it's going to go away. There are lots of people who think that if you've got radio frequency interference, if you're properly grounded, it's going to go away. Proper grounding may lower things by 5 dB, but if you've got hot wiring that's radiating a signal, it's going to be radiated. So he's got to stop it at the source, in my opinion. And the main question that Joe was asking is, what should that schematic look like? I don't have an answer directly, but I can tell you what was a successful approach used on Air Force circuitry for the B-1B bomber individual line replaceable units. Those 108 boxes that are on that airplane, each one of them is a man-carryable box with a handle on each end, and each one of them has got this so-called dirty box input, which is a pi filter network. There's something close to a 1 microfarad capacitor from each side to ground on the input end, an inductor that's in series, I don't know the number of millihenry, and another capacitor on the output end. The reason for that, let me drop it. The capacitor on the input end from the aircraft wiring shorts to ground any high-frequency signals that are about to go on that wiring. The series inductor gives you an awful lot of the filtering action. The capacitor on the other end of the filter, on the inside of the box, is to make sure that the power supply looks clean. There's many kinds of circuits that don't want to look into a pure inductor as a source of power. So it really was a pi filter network that was very successful, except for the fact that we were running them at 240 volts when they were rated for 120, and those oil-filled 1 microfarad capacitors, a certain percentage of those were exploding until we figured out what was going on. So a pi filter network is the Cadillac approach, but it's going to cost you some volume and some dollars. We're going to be coming back to this one. There's a lot more to go on this one, I can tell, Joe. I'm going to have to move on. We're going to go to Ed's question, if Ed happens to still be on frequency. He's got to get up early in the morning. KC2PYT, I wonder if you're still with us, Ed. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2PYT, I am indeed still here.
Okay, so what in the world was your question 2 weeks ago? I'm having some fun with him. Give me a two-sentence. Your two-sentence, I'm gonna put some words in your mouth. As an attorney, where the FCC rules were at the 50-watt level, the radio amateur is responsible for a calculation, verification, calculation, not exceeding the radio frequency biohazard. And some of your question is what happens at 51 watts? And I'm going to be answering that question. Is that some of your question, Ed, just to make sure we don't go too far left of center here? KC2PYT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, my question was, given that this is a requirement, that once you hit 51 watts, you're required to make that verification, how do you do it? And second, does anyone actually do it? Because it seems like, if for something that's required of us, it seems like very few people actually go to the effort to do so.
Yeah, I'm convinced, if I had to make a guess, I'll be amazed if 5% of the radio amateurs have even considered this. For two or three reasons. One, it's a pain. They've never done it in the past. It's a brand new requirement from their point of view. Number two, as you're about to find out, the words, the vocabulary, the calculations, and whatever that's involved is not simple. You can buy a book from AROL on the subject. It's a paperback book, and I think it's around $10. It gives you a lot of the information. I'm going to distill what I think is that book. I don't have a copy of that book in front of me. But I'm going to tell you what's involved and why. You're about to find out. You almost do not have to do the calculation. You'd be amazed at what the safety factor is. So let's go back to a little bit of the basics here. Let me drop. To some degree, every antenna we have ever built is sending a signal in every single direction in the space. If you took your globe that you've got sitting on your desk and you divided it into 1 degree squares, there's 41,253 squares on that globe. So if you look at every possible angle, 0 to 360 degrees azimuth, plus and minus 90 degrees in elevation, and you divide it all up into degrees, there's 41,000 degrees there. Every antenna is putting some amount of energy across every one of those degrees. Every real antenna is doing that. We think we've got a main lobe and maybe a couple of side lobes and a couple of back lobes and nothing else. Every antenna radiates in all directions. Therefore, the simplest way to look at this is to assume that the antenna that you're studying for electromagnetic interference, for radio frequency biohazard, you assume the antenna is isotropic. I'm now going to give you an example of what that would look like. Assume I had a perfect white incandescent light bulb. Assume the light bulb, in reality, down toward the socket, it's got a null in its pattern. But assume the white light bulb radiates light in all directions. Assume it's a 100-watt light bulb, and assume it really puts out 100 watts of light. No real bulb does that. And if now I put that bulb in the middle of a sphere, and if I make the sphere 2.8 meters in radius, 5.6 meters in diameter. I make the sphere 5.6 meters in diameter, and I've got this perfect isotropic incandescent light bulb, a white light bulb in the center of that sphere. The magic of those numbers of 2.8 meters of radius, 82 meters of radius, is that the sphere has an area of exactly 100 square meters. So if my light bulb is truly isotropic and is putting out 100 watts of light, and if the sphere that it's inside of has 100 square meters of area, it's obvious that each square meter is going to get 1 watt of light. And you could go on and actually do that experiment, and people have done things like that. Let me drop. The next question is, what happens if I don't have the sphere? I've got a 1 square meter black board, a board that's, you know, black to lighting, and I locate it 2.82 meters away from the light bulb. I've got the exact same radius. I didn't put the whole damn sphere there. I've got the same 1 square meter of absorbing material. I put it 2.8 meters away from the light bulb. What will happen? I will see exactly 1 watt of light be absorbed by my 1 square meter of absorbing material. So the fact that the other 99 square meters are not there doesn't matter. That's factor number one. So the area of your receiving device is what determines how much power you get. How much power you get is a function of how strong is the source, how far away is the source, and what absorbing device. So now you can hear that the area makes a lot of difference. In order to really quantitatively measure electromagnetic radio frequency biohazard, let me drop. In theory, we could go out and buy some very expensive hardware. We could buy a machine that measures volts per meter at various frequencies. We could buy a machine that measures power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeter. The majority of the measurements that are made for biohazard are done in the units of milliwatts per square meter. How much power across each unit of area is the radio energy impinging on the potential victim? And in the case of VHF frequencies, 30 to 300 megacycles, where the vast majority of the RF energy hitting your body gets absorbed, gets turned into heat. And now the next thing you worry about is how much heat does that portion of the body get and can it tolerate it? They do it in milliwatts per square centimeter. I think of a couple of reasons for doing that. Instrumentation at the one square centimeter level is pretty easy to build if you were building a machine that's making the measurement directly. Second of all, the most vulnerable part of a human being is the human eye. And an open human eye, the area of that eye that's exposed is in the vicinity of a square centimeter. Let me drop. For a whole lot of years, the biohazard rating for the United States was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. It's recently been lowered under various conditions down to 1, particularly if the potential victim has no knowledge that he's coming into a radio signal area. But I'm going to continue using the 10 milliwatts because it's a much more reasonable number, because it already has a 10 to 1 safety factor built into it. The original measurement that was done in the 1940 time frame was a rabbit was clamped into a fixture with his eye open, and they were putting RF energy into his eye, and they kept increasing it to the point of 100 milliwatts per square centimeter is where he finally had enough heating of his eye that he developed a cataract. And that's a very severe test, because the poor animal was clamped down, couldn't move. No human being would tolerate that. His eye was being held open. No human being would tolerate that. At even the 10 milliwatts per square centimeter number, which happens to be 100 watts per square meter, 100 watts per square meter, where your body has about a half a square meter of area, if I gave you whole body absorption of RF energy at 100 watts per square meter, you would feel the heat on your eyelid, you would feel the heat on your face, you'd feel the heat on your arms, your hands, you would feel, even if you were a blind person, you would think somebody put you out into the sun on a sunny day and you'd feel the difference. So for a whole bunch of reasons, you wouldn't sit there and stare into the source for 6 solid minutes with your eye open and not move. As you can see, that the test was a very severe test. Real human beings don't behave that way. Let me drop. And the human eye has a time constant of 6 minutes. That's why the rating, the defining document for the United States is the C95 report, the American National Standards Institute C95 report. You take those words, you Google them just right, you'll eventually get a copy of this 50-page document. I didn't say it's easy to read, but it's all there. It's like the New York Times. And you study it enough and you'll find out that the amount of RF energy that a human being is exposed to when integrated over a 6 minute period is what determines whether or not it's safe or not safe. So as I was starting to say, Ed, you and I could go out and buy expensive instrumentation to measure milliwatts per square centimeter in a calibrated manner traceable to the bureau. We could also buy a meter that measures millivolts volts per meter. 10 milliwatts per square centimeter happens to be 194 volts per meter. When you use the impedance of space of 377, I won't go there. I'm going to show you how to make a very simple test. Let me drop. The most easily obtained antenna that you and I could use at, say, 2 meters is a 2 meter dipole. The 2 meter dipole would be roughly 38 inches tip to tip. You could build it out of coat hanger wire, out of 14 gauge copper wire. There's a zillion ways that you and I could build a high performance 2 meter dipole. The 2 meter dipole has a gain, like every dipole has, a gain of 2.14 dB. When it's in free space under normal conditions, 2.14 decibels of gain. That's because it's got a donut-like pattern in three-dimensional space, and in the strong directions of the donut, the signal is 1.64 times louder than it would be, 1.64 times louder than on average, if you know what I mean. That's why it's got 2.14 dB of gain. 2.14 decibels, if you anti-log it, you'll find that it's a ratio of 1.64. Now, with a simple test you and I can easily do, if you really want to do the test, and you're going to see how amazing the results are, I start up with a dipole that has 50 watts going into it, and I'm going to stand 10 feet away from it with a second dipole, another 2-meter dipole. Let me drop. So with very few dollars expended, you and I could do this test. And I'm going to show you what the test would show. You've got a 2-meter dipole, 50 watts. You've got a 50-watt mobile transmitter. You've got it connected to your dipole. You're going to run a key down for a certain period of time in the FM mode. And by way of a third watt meter or whatever, you can confirm that it's really putting out 50 watts, 51 watts, if that's what you're worried about. 10 feet away, you've got a second dipole. I chose 10 feet because it's something I could easily do in my backyard. I could set it up in such a way where I got the two dipoles high enough above the ground that the ground reflection is not a serious contaminant. So I could put these two dipoles on the roof of my house, so to speak, or one of them in front of the tower and one of them on the tower. There's various ways I could put two dipoles on 2 meters, 10 feet apart. And if I did that, what would I see? Let me show you the mathematics of this. First of all, remember with that light bulb in the spherical room, the area of the receiving device, the 1 square meter in that case, tells me how much energy I'm going to absorb. Therefore, the first thing you and I care about, let me drop. First thing we care about is what is the area, what is the receiving area of a 2-meter dipole. The wire itself you use has only got a couple of square inches of area. You know, the shadow it casts on the ground at high noon is only a couple of square meters. You know that radio-wise, that dipole really has a lot more area. Turns out there's an exact calculation for that. The area of any antenna, this is a very handy formula. Area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. If you know the gain of the antenna as a real number, not decibels, you know the wavelength, you square it, so gain times lambda squared divided by 4 pi, that equals the area, and as long as you've done the area in square meters, you get the lambda in meters, you get an area in square meters. You apply that formula to a 2-meter dipole. Your 2-meter dipole has got 2.14 dB of gain, that's a 1.64 number. So the gain number is 1.64. You know what the wavelength of 2 meters is like, you know what 4 pi is, and you're going to divide it. You do that calculation. A 2-meter dipole has an area of, where did I put that down here, 5.92 square feet, 0.55 square meters. A 2-meter dipole does have a calculatable, measurable radio area of 0.55 square meters. So your receiving antenna for this experiment is a dipole receiving the signal 10 feet away from the dipole that's doing the transmitting, and we now know it's got an area of 0.55 square meters. Okay, we have a certain space between the two antennas. It's got so-called free space laws, that 10 feet of area. The formula we use for that, the general formula that most of us could use in the real world, where I've got a transmitting antenna in Huntington, and you've got a receiving antenna in the Queens area.
Repeater, time out.
And there's some number of miles between us. Let me get a beep. So, assuming my antenna that's doing the transmitting is up on a tower, I've got direct line of sight to you in Queens, and we know how many miles are between us. For the time being, we're going to ignore the ground reflection and the absorption of the trees. I've got direct line of sight, but I know the number of miles, and I know the frequency. A very convenient formula that we can use in many cases is how many decibels of free space loss is there? Because what we're going to do here is we know we've got a certain number of watts going into the transmitting antenna. The transmitting antenna has a certain number of decibels of gain. We had to multiply that out. Your receiving antenna over there in Queens has a certain amount of areas doing the receiving. If it was a dipole, it's 0.55 square meters at 2 meters. So we know the receiving area. And the only thing in between is the free space loss. Free space loss, the beautiful formula that's easy to use on that one is the following. It's got three terms to it. The first term is a fixed number, 36.6. The second term is 20 times the log of F. F is frequency in megahertz. The third term is 20 times the log of D. D is distance in miles. So, the formula for decibels of free space loss, 36.6 plus 20 log base 10 of F frequency plus 20 log base 10 of D distance in miles. And that D in miles, you're allowed to use 10 feet. That's a certain number of miles. A mile is 5,280 feet. So 10 divided by 5,280, and I divide that out, and I get just a very small number, 0003 or something like that, and I take the log of that, multiply by 20. So this formula doesn't matter, even though you're talking about an extremely small fraction of a mile for this experiment. Let me drop.
Is the frequency in megahertz or frequency in hertz?
Yeah, I already said that, and I'll say it again, Joe. A frequency is in megahertz, distance in miles. So that formula, frequency, megahertz, distance in miles. And so whether you're using 10 feet, which is a very small fraction of a mile, I use that formula. If I'm using the Voyager spacecraft at 12 billion miles, I use that formula. And by the way, at 12 billion miles, you end up with something like 319 decibels of free space loss. That's a big number. So, even if you're talking about an extremely small fraction of a mile, inches or feet, or 12 billion miles, the exact same formula works. It's a very, let's call it linear formula. It obeys the inverse square law. So, now, what happens at 10 feet at 2 meters? You plug that formula, free space loss, it's going to strike you as amazingly large. Because it's an inverse square law thing, it starts with a big number at first. The first mile is where you get the most of the loss in every radio circuit. 10 feet at 2 meters has free space loss of 25.14 dB. So 25 dB of loss is 10 feet at 2 meters. The transmitting power, the 50 watts, is going into an antenna with 2.4 dB of gain. That's a dipole. You multiply that out, 2.14 again is that 1.64 number. 50 watts times 1.64 is 81.8 watts. Your effective radiated power, 50 watts into your dipole, it acts like an isotropic antenna of 81 watts. Now, there's a zillion ways you can calculate this situation now. Let me drop. I'm going to start off with the effective radiated power of the transmitting dipole. I'm going to rate it in dB with reference to a milliwatt, dBm. That's my favorite units. The free space loss is some number of dB, 2.5 dB, we just talked about it. The receiving antenna, you can either do it as an area relationship, as I told you earlier, or you can do it receiving area converted to a gain device, 2.14 dB of gain. So one way of doing it in decibels, the 81.8 watts does convert into 49 dB with reference to a milliwatt. 49 decibels stronger than 1 milliwatt. So my transmitting power is plus 49. My free space loss is minus 25. My receiving antenna gain is plus 2.14. Those three numbers tell me how strong is the signal going to be received. Plus 49, minus 25, plus 2, I'm dropping the decimal places. It ends up as 25.8 positive dBm. In other words, that receiving dipole, 50 watts being transmitted into one, 10 feet away, another dipole is receiving it, you will get plus 25.8 dBm of received power. That's 384 milliwatts. Let me drop. You do that experiment, you will receive 384 milliwatts. You can't put that directly into your 2-meter receiver. You're going to put an attenuator in between the two. And by way of a signal generator, you can easily calibrate that system. But now, what does that 384 milliwatts into your dipole really give you? Because we know the dipole has got an effective area of 0.55 square meters, that turns out to be 384 milliwatts across 0.55 square meters. That's 700.